This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
When we spoke to them, the first thing they asked for is water, shelter, food, and education. Education is just as important to them.
That was Yasmin Sharif, Executive Director of Education Cannot Wait, the UN Global Fund for Education in Emergencies and Protracted Crisis, on the priorities for Sudanese children crossing into Chad. Details coming up. Also, a delegation of African leaders will soon travel to Russia and Ukraine to present a peace plan. And Namibia's Supreme Court rules in favor of recognizing same-sex marriages from other countries. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Airstrikes, explosions, and clashes echoed in the south of Khartoum today as international negotiators tried again to nail down a ceasefire between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. The fighting has triggered unrest in other areas of Sudan, especially in the western region of Darfur, but is concentrated in Khartoum. It has caused a humanitarian crisis that threatens to destabilize the region, displacing more than 700,000 people inside Sudan and forcing about 200,000 to flee into neighboring countries. United Nations agencies are appealing to international donors to scale up support and funding to provide education to Sudanese children who have been displaced from their homes. The agencies say education will help protect the refugee children from multiple risks and exploitation. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The latest protection monitoring reports show about half of the families arriving from Sudan into Chad have school-age children. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says 83% of these children had been attending schools in Sudan before they were forced to flee. UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Serrado says it is crucial that they continue their education as soon as possible. She says school protects children from many risks they are likely to face while in exile.
Child protection, child marriage, early marriage is one of the main concerns that we have, especially in Chad, of the children that are arriving, as well as child labor. And that's why we're making all the efforts from the start of the emergency to include a school as part of the priority responses.
Yasmin Sharif is Executive Director of Education Cannot Wait, the UN Global Fund for Education in Emergencies and Protracted Crises. She participated in a high-level field mission with UNHCR and UNICEF to the border regions of Chad with Sudan, where 60,000 refugees recently arrived. She says children account for nearly 70% of the pre-registered refugees. She says the children who had arrived in the past few days with their parents and grandparents were deeply traumatized and terrified by their experience. The children said they had to hide during the day because they were being pursued during their flight by the rebels waging war in western Darfur. She says children in Sudan have not gone to school for the past 6 months for fear of being killed, kidnapped, sexually abused, and recruited as child soldiers by the warring parties. She says parents around the world want their children to go to school so they have a chance to create better lives for themselves.
When we spoke to them, the first thing they asked for is water, shelter, food, and education. Education is just as important to them. And you can embed water, food, and shelter and protection in education. You get interconnected components of all of this by providing education, while also giving them a hope for the future.
Sharif says her agency is allocating $3 million as an initial grant to provide an education for newly arriving children in Chad. But she notes much more money than that will be needed to get the growing number of Sudanese refugee children back to school. Since conflict erupted between the Sudanese army and paramilitary rapid support forces on April 15th, more than 200,000 people have fled to the Central African Republic, Chad, Egypt, Ethiopia, and South Sudan. The UNHCR estimates this number could reach 860,000, including hundreds of thousands of children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says the number of people who fled from Sudan to Chad has doubled to 55,000 in the last week, and many are women and children. Henry Wilkins spoke to Sudanese refugees who just arrived at a newly created camp in Borota, Chad.
Aid groups are struggling to help 25,000 refugees who arrived in Chad from Sudan last week. The recent influx has almost doubled the number of Sudanese refugees in the country since the Sudan civil war began April 15th. To reach the site of a camp housing the new arrivals, VOA flew from the capital, N'Djamena, and then drove 4 hours to the remote town of Borota on the Chad-Sudan border. Here, a settlement that didn't exist a week ago is now the size of a town. The refugees have come from western Darfur, which has been ravaged by lawlessness and intercommunal violence, mostly consisting of ethnically Arab armed groups terrorizing black Sudanese. Sudan's conflict triggered the spate of violence. Refugee Khadija Abeb Abdul Rahman told VOA how it is she arrived at Borota. She said she's coming from the town of Konga because of the fighting. There are a lot of terrorists there, and that's why so many refugees have fled. She adds that the small bundle she is carrying on her head is all she was able to bring with her. She is in need of food and security. Meanwhile, Isaac Bakar says he has been living in Borota since last week. He describes seeing a group of armed men raiding his hometown of Konga before he fled. He says they were breaking into people's houses to steal money, and if you didn't have money, they forced you out of your home and sent people south or killed them. He says he saw them killing people, and that if he had a phone, he would have recorded it. The mayor of Borota, Toko Bahat, says he is happy to welcome the refugees as his guests and points out his community has strong ties with those across the border, but resources are strained. He says people need a lot of help with food and especially water. Because there's no rain, there is a scarcity. There are also children in need of assistance and refugees who have no jobs. UNHCR is putting basic sanitation in place and bringing water, but warns there is still much to do. Eugene Buyun is a UNHCR spokesperson.
The need is great, and our support is minimized because of a funding shortfall. We really calling for international community to support and continue to support to those new arrivals.
Chad's rainy season starts this month. The deep gullies on the road to Borota will fill with water, making access for aid groups more difficult. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Borota, Chad.
Proceedings in the rape case against Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko have been adjourned until next week. Reporter Alpha Diallo in Dakar has more.
Opposition leader Ousmane Sonko did not appear in the court in Dakar today when his trial opened. Shortly afterwards, the judge postponed further proceedings until May 23rd. The case is considered most publicized rape allegation in Senegal history. Sonko is leader of Passive Patriots Party. He is accused of raping Adjira Bissar, who worked at a massage saloon in Dakar, and making death threats against her. If Sonko is convicted, he faces up to 10 years in prison and would be barred for running for president. Sonko has denied all allegations and said they are intended to keep him from running for the presidency. Yesterday, there were violent protests in both the capital city, Dakar, and the Ziguinchor, the regional capital of the southern provinces of Casamance, where Sonko is mayor. At least 3 people, including a police officer, were reported killed in the unrest, and protesters vandalized several businesses. Sonko recently received a 6-month suspended prison sentence and was fined 200 million CFA francs in a defamation case against the Minister of Tourism. He is appealing that case. Reporting for VOA News, this is Alpha Diallo in Dakar.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says a delegation of African leaders will soon travel to Russia and Ukraine to present a peace plan. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
President Cyril Ramaphosa's announcement of the planned trip came Tuesday during a media briefing with Singaporean Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong. He says a group of African heads of state want to put forward a peace initiative that could contribute to a solution to the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
We have been talking about as African leaders because we concluded that that conflict in that part of the world, much as it does not affect Africa directly in the form of deaths and destruction to our infrastructure, it does have an impact on the lives of many Africans with regard to food security. The prices of fertilizers have gone up, prices of cereals have gone up, and the prices of fuel.
Ramaphosa says he spoke to Presidents Putin and Zelensky, who agreed that they would be willing to receive a mission of the African heads of state in both their capitals, Moscow and Kyiv. In addition to South Africa, Zambia, Senegal, Congo Brazzaville, Uganda and Egypt are all part of the initiative. The talks have been facilitated by the Brazzaville Foundation, a London-based non-profit organization that focuses on conflict resolution. Ramaphosa says preparations for the meetings to take place as soon as possible have already begun. Both the Secretary General of the United Nations and the African Union have been briefed on the plan. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
South Africa's main opposition party is demanding to know why there is high-level defense delegation in Moscow discussing increased cooperation and combat readiness. The news comes just days after the U.S. ambassador accused South Africa of selling weapons to Russia in violation of its claims of non-alignment in Moscow's war on Ukraine. Again, Vicky Stark has the latest from Cape Town, South Africa.
The Democratic Alliance spokesperson on defense and lawmaker Cobus Marais says the visit led by the chief of the South African Army, Lieutenant General Lawrence Mbata, was unannounced.
This once again demonstrates the ANC government's insensitivity to our diplomatic and trade dilemma. The unsolicited visit is the latest incident in a string where the South African government clearly and unashamedly demonstrates its support for Russia.
U.S. Ambassador to South Africa Reuben Brigetsi made headlines last week when he said he would bet his life that South Africa had supplied arms to Russia. Marais, who is the Shadow Minister of Defense and Military Veterans, says the Democratic Alliance has intelligence on what Brigetsi referred to. He says something worthy of being guarded by men in uniform was loaded onto a Russian cargo ship, the Lady R, when it was docked at Simonstown Naval Base in December.
We also know that the U.S. is probably the most advanced in terms of observation technology, and specifically with regard to satellites. We know that they can zoom into any port or airport or even battlefield and tell you exactly what color shirt and pants you are wearing. So I assume that they have got their own intelligence that can be used to see from above.
Marais says the unconfirmed rumors that ammunition was taken onto the Lady R seem plausible because the Russian military is struggling in Ukraine.
What we know is what has been reported, that they are in dire straits in terms of ammunition, but that is why we need to establish and know what they've loaded. We know there's not consumables like apples and pears.
In WhatsApp messages, Ukraine's ambassador to South Africa, Lyubov Abravitova, wrote that it is disturbing how Russia is eager to make South Africa appear to be on its side, and even more disturbing that South Africa is not postponing engagements such as the delegation's trip to Moscow. Referring to a statement by South Africa's military that the visit to Moscow was planned well in advance, Abravitova said previously made arrangements between Russia and South Africa cannot justify the intensification of military contacts with the country that violates all possible rules of international law and UN Charter. South African officials are trying to decide whether to host Russian President Vladimir Putin at the BRICS summit it is holding for leaders of its partner countries in the bloc, Brazil, Russia, India and China. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Putin on charges of war crimes involving the alleged abduction of children from Ukraine. Political analyst Professor Bekim Gomezulu of Nelson Mandela University says if he had his way, he would ask Putin not to come.
Simply because with him coming here, that will put us in a very awkward situation. At the moment, we are signatories of the Rome Statute, which therefore means that we are obliged to arrest him.
The BRICS summit takes place in August. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
The Supreme Court of Namibia has ruled in favor of recognizing same-sex marriages from other countries, making Namibia only the second nation on the continent to do so after South Africa. Victoria Angula reports from Windhoek, Namibia.
A small group of LGBTQ activists gathered at Namibia's Supreme Court Tuesday, where justices ruled in a 4-1 vote that Namibians married to foreign nationals in foreign jurisdictions must be recognized as any other couple within the country. One of the judges, J.A. Mainga, dissented on the basis that the laws of Namibia do not recognize same-sex relationships. The other four judges, however, ruled that not recognizing same-sex couples infringes on their rights to dignity and equality. VOA spoke to the legal counsel of the same-sex couples, Carly Schrickeling, who appealed an earlier judgment of the High Court of Namibia not to recognize their same-sex marriages.
Today, after a six-year battle, we finally won, and the court has ruled that the Ministry of Home Affairs has to recognize these marriages by foreign spouses to Namibian spouses.
Over the past few months, the Supreme Court of Namibia has been hearing similar cases that deal with the subject of homosexuality. In one case, a Namibian citizen, Friedel Dausab, is asking for the repeal of an anti-sodomy law. In another case, which was dismissed in March, a Mexican national and his Namibian partner asked the top court to grant Namibian citizenship to their child, conceived through surrogacy in South Africa. The Mexican national in that case, Guillermo Delgado, spoke to VOA outside the Supreme Court on Tuesday.
Our case is very similar, and this represents a direct victory also for us. It's recognition of our marriage and our dependence.
Linda Baumann of the Diverse Women's Organization said this judgment will help homosexual couples get access to the same services as heterosexual couples. Hypothetically speaking, she said, as a lesbian woman, she could bequeath her estate to her lesbian partner when she dies, or she might be able to buy a house together with a same-sex spouse if the court gave rights to same-sex couples in all spheres of society. She cautioned that this is just a ruling.
It's important to understand, firstly, the case, the status of this case. It's couples that are coming back to this country to claim their right to equality, their right to dignity, the right to family. But to answer that question on same-sex marriages, I believe that a lot of LGBT people in this country, we experience a number of inequalities in service, in benefits, in having the right to say something over your partner.
While over 30 African countries have laws prohibiting same-sex relationships, Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa have taken a different stance. Many gay Namibian couples now get married in South Africa. And after Tuesday's ruling, activists are asking whether gay couples should have the right to get married in Namibia as well. Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Two of Europe's biggest oil companies, Shell and Total Energies, along with America's Chevron, are preparing to finance a fossil fuel boom in Namibia. Large oil and gas deposits were found off the coast of the southern African country in early 2022. But environmentalists are arguing the billions of dollars expected to be invested in Namibia's oil industry should be spent on renewable energy in a country perfectly placed to generate solar and wind power. Darren Taylor reports.
The discovery of oil and gas fields in Namibian waters coincided with the beginning of the Ukraine conflict in February last year. The conflict sparked global oil shortages and fuel cost increases. Western countries and others are also boycotting Russian oil and gas, meaning they're looking for alternative sources of these fossil fuels to stave off energy crises. In that sense, says Professor Raymond Durheim, the discoveries off the southwest African coast couldn't have come at a better time for Namibia.
Namibia imports virtually all of its energy. Energy supply is constrained and sometimes unreliable. They would like to have, I imagine, better control over their energy security. And then, of course, there's all the opportunity, and there could be opportunities for employment, and of course that depends on the deal that's done between the government and the oil companies that are given the licenses to develop the oil fields, exactly how they structure that. And then, of course, there's the royalties and taxes that can come from this.
Durheim, who teaches geosciences at Wits University in Johannesburg, says President Hage Geingob's government plans to export the oil and gas, putting billions of dollars into its coffers.
Well, I think something like this can be both a blessing and a curse. What benefit flows to the country, well, that depends on how the government actually deploys income that they earn, whether it's spent just on prestige projects that benefit a few, or whether it's truly invested in the country, in educational systems, in developing other industries that can provide employment as well, or perhaps even into a sovereign wealth fund, which is what countries like Norway have done. They take the money and invest it worldwide, so they will continue to get dividends from this, which is an ongoing benefit for their land.
Speaking at an energy conference last year, Director of Petroleum Affairs at Namibia's Energy Ministry, Carlo McLeod, said his government was committed to using oil revenue to the benefit of all Namibia's 3 million citizens.
Oil and gas discoveries are always a game changer, and it means that there's more revenue, more opportunities. The person on the street will obviously have a better standard of life.
But, as Durheim points out, Africa's mineral-enriched governments have seldom used oil and gas profit to improve citizens' lives. They've usually just made elites even richer. These concerns are heightened by the poor business reputation of Namibia's state petroleum corporation, NAMCOR, with its managing director currently suspended for alleged corruption. Durheim's concerned, too, about the effect oil operations could have on fishing, one of Namibia's biggest foreign exchange earners. Environmentalists are also protesting because barely a year after Namibia committed itself to becoming one of the world's biggest producers of solar and wind energy, it's now set to be one of Africa's biggest producers of fossil fuels. These release harmful gases into the atmosphere, causing climate change. The Namibian government says it is still committed to renewable energy, but that it can't afford to ignore the obvious financial benefits of harnessing and selling oil and gas. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Pete Hunley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.